Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, the last of three installments from the annual lecture series entitled The Fascination with Jewish Tales by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight we hear Evil and Redemption. Introducing Professor Wiesel is the director of the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation, Rabbi Joseph Pollack.
In 1996, in Dunblane, Scotland, a man came into a kindergarten and shot many of the children. A day or two later, the Boston Globe reported that some schools in this community had hired psychologists to assure children that what happened in Dunblane wasn't about to happen here. The psychologist in one such school apparently told the children that had someone talked to the killer that day, had he somehow reassured him, that he wouldn't have done what he did. Crime, in other words, is a mental health issue and not an act of evil. Alas, evil does exist in this world, and no one has done more, by virtue of his extraordinary eloquence as a victim, to make this point with undaunted clarity than has Elie Wiesel. Yet as clearly as he has pointed his finger at the perpetrators of evil, Elie Wiesel has, with particular ferocity, exposed the role of the bystander. I recall reading a fragment from a diary of a victim of the Warsaw Ghetto during its liquidation. Thousands of Jews in tattered clothing, gaunt and without energy, are shuffling silently to the Umschlagplatz where the trains awaited them. Our diarist, not Elie Wiesel, our diarist looks up and notices, on the so-called Aryan side, a woman watering the flowers on her balcony. She looks up, stares at the pitiful procession, and then, to the horror of the diarist, resumes watering her flowers. How has this come about, the diarist wonders, that children and their parents marching to their deaths in Auschwitz and Treblinka are of no consequence to Polish society? It was Elie Wiesel who took up this question after the war and refused to let it lie with the victims in their ashes. There is a tape somewhere of Rabbi Weissmandl weeping in the United States in the 1950s, weeping so deeply that it is almost impossible for the listener to bear. The rabbi, together with a small Jewish group in which he worked, risked everything to save the Jews of Slovakia, of which he was one of the few survivors. He jumped off his Auschwitz-bound train. In the tape, he cries, "It was all a question of money. We were able to buy off the Germans. Why didn't you Americans send us the money when we asked you for it? Mothers, children went to their death because you stood by." And in this very university, David Wyman, a grandchild of two Christian ministers and the eloquent historian and archivist of the American response to the Holocaust, admitted that when he was finally ready to write the chapter of the role of the American church in the Holocaust, he too, like Rabbi Weissmandl, sat down and wept. Last week in this room, Elie Wiesel told us that the title of his book on the religious persecution of Soviet Jewry under the communists, The Jews of Silence, this title was meant not for Soviet Jews, but for world Jewry, which was standing idly by its brethren. And in the conference auditorium next door, a few years ago, there was a meeting of hundreds of physicians and scientists talking about Nazi medicine. I prevailed on Elie Wiesel to visit with them at the end of their conference. He said to them, "At the end of the war, in 1945, the numbers of people with typhus, with malnutrition, with tuberculosis, was in the scores of thousands. Few doctors came, few nurses, and thousands, thousands more died. Where were you?" Professor Wiesel asked them. "Why didn't you come?" In this prophetic moral mode, Professor Wiesel has captured the attention and consciences of presidents and other world leaders. "We cannot stand idly by Rwanda," he has said to them. "We cannot stand idly by Kosovo. We cannot stand idly by Israel." Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to introduce tonight to you Elie Wiesel, who will speak about evil and redemption.
The title Redemption and Evil, or Evil and Redemption, of course, is a challenging one. We know a lot about both, and we shall begin with evil. And we shall begin with questions. How old is evil? Does it age? Is it timeless? Immortal, perhaps? Evil before it exists, said Lao Tse, actually has already had a past. Is it then a product of human activity? Clearly it preceded humankind, for as we learn from scripture, it existed already in paradise before Adam and Eve, our glorious and unfortunate forebears, were given the choice in establishing their first menu. Does it mean then that God created evil before he brought the first couple into history? In that case, what was its function? Certain Oriental religions believed in two divinities, one of good and the other of evil. We, as children of Abraham, don't. Our faith is monotheistic. There is one God, creator of all men and women. But does he use some angels as messengers of evil and others of good? Is the human heart their eternal battlefield? Is Satan evil when he challenges God in the case and the story and the life of Job? Does he really expect to win? Is he that cunning, that stupid? Was Hitler evil before he became Führer of the Third Reich? Was Stalin evil when he was a seminarian? When does one become evil? When one commits the first murder of betraying the humanity of man, is that person already evil? More questions may follow, but allow me to precede them with a clarification. I believe that evil may be found in answers, not in questions. And so I feel I'm permitted to wonder aloud. Not who, but what is evil? Just a sin? A transgression? An act of betrayal of God's will and his creature's faith? Can a good person do evil? Can an evil person do good? Is absolute evil by definition invincible? Can it also be an aberration of nature or mentality, an expression or reflection of banality on a different level? Since God is, he is everywhere, in every impulse, in every fiber, in every aspect of human endeavor. Are we to conclude that just as he dwells in suffering, does he also dwell in evil? Throughout centuries, these interrogations often linked to the disturbing phenomenon of theodicy, which we call in Hebrew tzaddik, veralo rasha v'tovlo. How come that a good person is suffering, is punished and tormented, whereas the wicked person is rewarded? So these phenomenon and other implications have forever preoccupied teachers and disciples of Talmud, theology and philosophy, from ancient and medieval times to contemporary thinkers, including Theodor Adorno and Hannah Arendt, psychologists such as Freud and Jung, modern commentators, among whom we find our own colleague, Lance Morrow, whose latest volume entitled Evil, an Investigation, is an exceptional contribution to the understanding of the problem, and to read it is rewarding. But perhaps we ought to return to the text in the book of Genesis. We shall do so, but before doing so, allow me to open my favorite customary parenthesis. And first, of course, I want to acknowledge and thank, as always, President Chobanian and President Emeritus Silber, the faculty, which is an extraordinary faculty, one of the best, I think, in the country. And I'm privileged to have some of my colleagues here. I want to thank Rabbi Pollack for his words, for his passion for memory. Rabbi Pollack's spirituality in this campus equals his knowledge. We share concerns and hopes regarding the challenges of remembrance, His talent in deciphering a biblical passage or a Talmudic commentary is inspiring. In the yeshiva, in my youth, I always studied in Chavrusa, always with a friend. To study Talmud alone is almost impossible. You need not only a teacher, you need a friend, a companion, with whom you argue and with whom you make peace. With Rabbi Pollack, in an atmosphere of companionship, we study, and thanks to him, I can really find the Chavrusa. My colleagues in the Center of Jewish Studies, the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies, and university professors, those who seem to have retired but didn't, and those who are still teaching students with fervor and distinction, I hope they know my deep respect and affection for them. My very able new assistant, Rachel Strauss, the organizers, the all university functions people, Amy Bottomley, Judith Sandonato, Jody Anderson, the president's host of the conference services, and the security services, the police department of Boston University. And, of course, my own students, all of them, those who have been with me for years and others who are taking only one course for one semester. Occasionally, they speak up in class, not enough. But when they do, we all listen. And when I listen to them, I feel proud. And so let's also thank the Bible. Without the Bible, we wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be the person I am. And let's open the book of Genesis and enter the chapter about the first sin, the first appearance of evil on the stage of religious history and its far-reaching consequences. In the text we read simply that in the beginning God is happy with his creation. Vayar Elokim Kitov. Everything, every day, Tuesday even twice. Everything seemed good. As for the human being, God goes farther. He's very pleased, and declares the first human beings, therefore, very good. But then things develop poorly, all of a sudden. God said to Adam that he may eat from any tree in the garden. Remember, he said to Adam, not to Eve, just to Adam. And God said, you may eat any tree except the tree of knowledge. If he does, he'll discover good and evil and die. But wait a second, what's so wrong with knowing, with having knowledge? Aren't we all actually eager to acquire more and more knowledge? What are we doing in this school? Are we going to close all the universities? Because God said, don't acquire knowledge. And I plead with the students, don't use that excuse for not studying. But remember again, paradise, you have already Adam, and you have Eve, and they seem to be happy too with each other. And then with the arrival of the serpent, the action changes course. The plot thickens, and the reader is caught up in the growing excitement. For the first time, the couple faced a third presence. Something was bound to happen. Either Adam and Eve would become closer to one another than ever before, or drift apart. Confronted with the serpent, they had to and were able to choose. For the first time, they were given a choice. They were in a situation of conflict. They were free, human, at last. The mechanism had been set much earlier. Remember, God had actually given Adam and Eve full freedom to roam through paradise, doing whatever they liked, eating whatever appealed to them. With the exception, one exception, they were not supposed to eat from one tree. And yes, God warned them firmly. Transgression would result in death. Now, mind you, at that time, they didn't know what that means. Nobody died before. So why were they afraid of dying? They weren't. In fact, they weren't. Neither husband nor wife actually knew anything about what it meant to obey or disobey, but they obeyed. And they would have obeyed had not the serpent intervened. He altered the existing rules, and thereafter Adam and Eve were no longer the same. Now, when you study the text and the commentaries, the serpent is a strange character. He is evil, actually the term used is shrewd. He's shrewd. When you think about it, what could he be shrewd about? But he was shrewd. He was mythical, yet real. His role, one source says, he was the angel's emissary. They had concluded that man would represent too formidable a challenge unless he could be made to stray and sin. It was the angel's fault. And they used the serpent to prevail upon Adam and Eve to sin. In those days, we are told, the serpent was not really a serpent. For the serpent walked like a man, talked like a man. And in fact, he talked quite well. He was very articulate. He was very eloquent, very persuasive. He knew how to convince and get others to obey. He was king of the beasts, we are told, a gambler, and vain and dead. He was easily persuaded to conspire against those humans, those potential rivals, who were eluding his authority. Other sources deny the angel's role in the conspiracy. They claim the initiative came from the serpent himself. He fell in love with Eve and planned to kill Adam and marry his widow. Better yet, he planned to arrange for God to kill Adam, then to abscond with Eve and her fortune, with the heiress and her inheritance. The whole world was hers. Well, the serpent, he aimed too high, a legend tells us, and he was punished. He obtained nothing of what he coveted and lost everything he could call his own. God told him, "No longer will you reign over the animals. Rather, from now on, your fate will be lowlier than theirs. No longer will you walk erect or run. From now on, you will crawl in the dust." Whatever the serpent's motivation may have been, one fact remains. His target was Eve. Why? Rightly or wrongly, he assessed the woman as being more vulnerable, more gullible, more malleable than her husband. He expected that of the two, she would offer the least resistance. His intuition proved right. Under his influence, Eve agreed to bite into the forbidden fruit. She even succeeded in turning her husband into an accomplice. And the moral of the story, perhaps, that everybody can be seduced. Women by Satan, men by woman. Here again, something in this episode will almost certainly disturb the careful reader. Is it conceivable that Eve could have hesitated even one second between the voice of the creator of the universe and that of the serpent, albeit a serpent on an extraordinary mission? We would find it easier to accept such a reaction from Adam between the demand of heaven and the promises of women. Man may well hesitate, or else not hesitate at all. But Eve, how could she possibly disregard God's will and submit to the will of a serpent? The thing is that I mentioned it already. She did not hear God's voice. Adam heard God's voice. And so she only heard the serpent's voice. And it's not her fault. Maybe it's God's fault. Why didn't he wait until Eve would come on stage and talk to both of them? Because at one point later on, he already speaks to them in plural, not in singular. But here is what happened according to legend. Obviously, it was all Eve's fault. Why? Because, as the Talmudic legend, she talked too much. Even before she tasted the forbidden fruit, she was guilty of exaggerating the facts. And as we all know, exaggeration leads to digression, which in turn leads straight to transgression. Now let us reread the text in the book of Genesis. God instructs Adam not to eat a certain fruit. Yet in her conversation with the serpent, I imagine, of course, that Adam couldn't hide anything from Eve. After all, he's a good husband. And he didn't want a scene at home. So he told her what God had told him. Exactly, don't eat. But she goes further. In her conversation with the serpent, Eve added something of her own to the prohibition. We were told not to eat from the tree, she said, and not even to touch it, for to do either would bring death upon us. Where did she find this second prohibition? Lesson number one. Fiction is a dangerous business. Lesson number two. One must choose one's conversation partner with care and not talk to just anyone, and surely not about theology. Eve's mistake was to enter into a dialogue with the serpent in the first place. She had a husband. Speak to him. Lesson number three. She was wrong in committing not only herself, but her absent husband as well, for he was absent. Lesson number four. It was Adam's problem. A husband should never leave his wife. Adam should not have left his house. Had he stayed home with his wife, the serpent would have had no chance of success. Eve had been an easy prey. The serpent knew just how to manipulate her. He knew that sin was one subject sure to interest Eve. No sooner had Eve made the serpent's acquaintance than she was already telling him the story of the forbidden fruit. She could not refrain from disclosing that which, after all, concerned only herself and her husband. "And you really believe this?" asked the serpent, looking surprised. "You who are so intelligent, so perceptive, so charming, you actually believe that it's enough to touch the tree to die?" When she did not answer, he walked up to the tree, and legend tells us the tree shouted with anger, "Don't touch me!" But the serpent didn't listen and put his arms around the tree. "You see," he said nonchalantly, "I touched it and I'm alive. Wouldn't you like to try it? Go ahead. Eve, go ahead. Nothing will happen to you." Eve remained apprehensive and did not move. She was curious, but distrustful. And then the serpent shoved her toward the tree. Says the legend in the Talmud, Eve saw the angel of death, but stayed alive. Yet it was, for her and for us, the beginning of the end. The first contact with death was then. Caught in the treadmill, she ventured farther and farther, too late to turn back, too late to erase what she had seen and experienced. What Eve did not understand was that she would find in the forbidden fruit not death, but the idea and the sensation of death, that it was possible for her to see the angel and not to succumb. She suddenly realized that life and death are not two separate domains. They meet in the human being, not in God. It is possible to live with death. All one needs to do is turn one's back on the living. It is possible to be dead before one dies. It's so simple. Just don't care. Don't listen to the cries of the hungry mother who cannot feed her children. Don't listen to anyone who needs a presence. Don't listen. Don't care. Then you die while you are still alive. But then why did Eve commit the irreparable? What drove her to the serpent? And why was it so important for her to touch the tree, or being even ready to be thrown towards the tree? Why didn't she stop in time? Could she have been already then attracted and fascinated by death, by nothingness? Could Adam have been fascinated already by evil? The Midrash advances the following hypothesis. Eve was tempted by the promise of power. "If you taste from the tree," the serpent had told her, "you shall be like God," who ate from the same tree before creating the world. "Like him, you shall have the power to build and to destroy, to kill and resurrect." And he convinced Eve that that was precisely what God had sought to prevent with his prohibition. "God was jealous," said the serpent. "God doesn't want anyone to be like him, not even in his image." So she opted for the serpent's clever arguments over God's dry commandment transmitted by her husband. Clearly, she was ripe for seduction, though one may theorize that she considered the serpent an instrument rather than an accomplice, and that she collaborated with him in order to establish her position of power. Nor was the serpent fooled. His game simply became more sophisticated. Once he obtained the first concession from the woman, namely that it was possible to touch the tree with impunity, he knew she would want to continue to push ahead and test God by testing herself. Only now, the serpent said no, evoking all sorts of pretexts. The more she wanted to bite into the fruit, the more he discouraged her. She pleaded with him, appealed to his feelings, to his sentiments, to his compassion. "I want a bite," she said. She appealed to him and reminded him of their friendship. Her excitement became unbearable. She had to eat this fruit no matter what the cost. Nothing else mattered anymore. Neither her dignity, her woman's pride, her fear, her security, nor her loyalty to her God who was present, or to her husband who was not. Driven by a passion she could no longer control, she knowingly courted disaster. She could not help herself. Her curiosity and her greed were stronger than she. And finally the serpent agreed, but on one condition, that she shared the fruit with her husband. And Eve, a woman to the end, could not resist the urge to make another promise. Then and only then did the serpent relent. He offered her the desired fruit. In passing, let me say, it was not an apple but a citrus. There are also those who say it was a bunch of grapes, while others maintain it was a fig. In any case, Eve took the fruit and held it in her hand, admiring its beauty, reluctant to swallow too quickly that which had cost her so dear. First she bit into the skin, careful not to eat the inside. Then she nibbled on a small piece. The effect was instantaneous. She discovered that she was mortal. For the first time, she genuinely, deeply understood that there was a direct, inescapable relationship between her person and life and the end of life. The game was up. God would keep his promise and strike. Instinctively she knew God keeps his pledges, especially when it comes to punishment. And yet, instead of desisting and repenting, she chose to use the serpent's stratagems on her husband and throw him into the same deadly trap. She already knew the price of disobeying God, and yet she tricked Adam into becoming her accomplice. Since she would have to pay, she owed it to herself to drag Adam along. The Midrash stresses that Eve behaved like a jealous woman. The idea that her husband might survive and possibly marry another seemed intolerable to her. Since she had to die, she would not die alone. But where was Adam all this time? What was he doing while his wife arranged and rearranged his universe and changed his destiny? One text says he was asleep. The world was changing, and the husband was asleep. Another, more charitable, assures us he was walking with God, who was showing him the world and teaching him to tame nature. The fact was that while Eve and the serpent were acting out their sin, Adam was elsewhere. Perhaps it's not unusual. Perhaps his wife's constant chatter had finally irritated him. He must have yearned for a measure of peace and silence, and since he couldn't find it at home, he went away. No, let's admit it. Adam was a weakling. And between the two, why not prefer Eve? He remained passive, always. Unlike most mythological figures, he does not strike the reader as a leader of men, a giant who dictates his law. He demanded nothing from anyone, sought no glory. He built no empires, nor did he erect any temples. His modesty was such that he accepted to play a secondary role in his own tragedy. Significantly, the tale of that tragedy is told by Eve, not Adam, in the apocryphal book named after them, Sefer Adam v'Chava, the book of Eve and Adam. The tale told in the first person is as poignant as it is convincing. It's a beautiful story. Toward the end of her life, Eve gathered her children and her children's children around her. And she said, "When I was young, I met Satan in paradise. His face was shining, and he sang the praises of the Almighty. I thought he was an angel. He seemed so pure. Then he seduced me to committing the one act I should not have committed." Here we come to a very, very puzzling and disturbing possibility. Obviously, Satan, the serpent or Satan, she said, was evil, and yet she took him as an angel. Is it possible, therefore, that evil may have all the attributes, all the appearances of good? But in that case, how are we to distinguish one from the other? There is one Hasidic tale, one of the most frightening Hasidic tales, and most of them are charming. This one is frightening. About Rabbi Elimelech of Lizensk, a very great master, author of Noam Elimelech, and he said that before Rabbi Yisrael Bar Shem Tov, the master of the good name, came down to earth, before his soul was sent down to be with other people, Satan came running to God and said, "Tell me, O God, is redemption near? Because, look, it's unfair. If that's what you want, then say so. Then I retreat. But otherwise, it's clear. If the Baal Shem Tov is with us, everybody will go to him. And everybody will listen to him. And everybody will repent. And everybody will just. And then it's finished. I have nothing to do. Is that what you want?" God said, "No, not yet. No, redemption is not here yet." Then what should we do?" Said God, "I cannot withdraw my decree. I already decided he should go down. What I can do is something. I have an idea," said God. "Together with his soul, another soul will come down. And that soul too will actually enter into a person who will behave and speak and teach and learn as a master, a great master. And many people will come to him. And only you and I will know that his soul does not belong to me but to you." My God, in that case, how are we ever to know who is the true master? You see, the question remains question. The question is not if evil and good are separate. The question is when evil and good are not separate. The question is for us, and the problem which confronts us is, how can we fight evil when evil has the appearances, or at least the attributes, or at least the aspects of good too? Can one fight evil? Yes, we can. Except if it's absolute. Is there absolute evil? There is. How are we to know when evil is absolute? Simple. Evil is absolute when the suffering it causes is absolute. And in our tradition, usually we don't speak really about evil people that much. We speak about evil deeds of people. There's a famous debate between Rabbi Meir and his wife Bruria, because some sinners were bothering them. Rabbi Meir pleaded, he said, "Yitamuch chataim, let the sinners be annihilated." And she argued with him. He said, "It's not chataim. It's not chotim, it's chataim. It's not, the sins should be annihilated, but not the sinners. Because absolute evil can only be measured if its suffering is absolute. Is there absolute evil today? I don't think so, but there is surely evil today. And I would say that today, if we have to fight evil, it is certainly born in an atmosphere of fanaticism, of religious bigotry, and religious terrorism, what we call the terrorist killers. Why are they evil? Because they make no distinction between children and their parents, between old people or young, between learned and ignorant, between artists and laborers. They kill. And they commit suicide not because they want to die, but because they want to kill. And in order to kill more, they kill themselves. And what is so perturbing is that they all claim to do that for the sake of heaven, for God, not knowing or not wanting to know that those who kill for God make their God into a God of death, a God of murder, that they make their God into murderer. That is absolute and evil thought and evil acts. And therefore, today, we witness a phenomenon. The killer's fascination with death equals ours, not only with life, but with hope. Does it mean, therefore, that this is now the time when, like in ancient time, in 2,000 years ago, even the old sects in Judea, the Essenians, for instance, spoke about the war of the children of light against the children of darkness? Does it mean that today there is a dichotomy, there is a separation, on one hand the good, on the other hand the evil? Does it mean, therefore, that we must choose absolute evil to fight the absolute good, to fight those who believe in that? I cannot believe that. I don't believe in collective evil. I don't believe in collective guilt. I don't believe in collective punishment. I don't believe in that. Only the sinner is a sinner. Only the killer is an assassin. And therefore, we cannot come out and simply say those, all of them are therefore not only carriers of evil thoughts and ideas, but there are, all of them are evil. But can we fight them? Of course we can. There are many, many ways of fighting them. And each of them actually is there only because with each act, somehow we are supposed to hasten the era of redemption. When redemption comes, when salvation comes, or in the messianic times, there will be no more evil. That's the whole idea. No more evil. People will become better. Does it mean that everybody will become Jewish? Nonsense. It will be too boring. We believe simply that when the Messiah will come, everyone will become more human, more hospitable, warmer to each other. And that can become not through divine intervention, but in the life of our own self, we can bring about a certain part of redemption, a spark of redemption, to use a Kabbalistic term. And therefore, there are responses to evil, psychological responses, literary responses, theological responses, human responses, and all must be, of course, based on the principles of humanity. It is not what I do to God that matters. It is what I do to the other person. If I come closer to the other, if I make his or her life, let's say, better, more open to hope, to promise, to joy, then I think we bring the Messiah closer. But the real danger, in our tradition at least, is not really the existence of evil as opposed to the existence of God. It is the mixture. The mixture, the apocalypse, the time of the apocalypse, when everything is mixed together, when good and evil are not only taking each other's shape or form, but they're together. One is in the other. And therefore, I remember in Hasidic literature, the Rabbi of Rizhin said, when the Messiah will come, at that time, summer will be without heat, winter without frost. The wise will have forgotten their wisdom, and the elect their fervor. And he also said, at that time, one will no longer distinguish light from what negates light, twilight from dawn, silence from speech, and speech from his content. There will no longer be any relation between man and his face, desire and its object, metaphor and its meaning, the Nimshal and the Mashal. And these are, of course, Orwellian premonitions and predictions before their time. The enemy resides not in the triumph of evil, but in chaos. The confusion of values is worse than their disappearance. Satan will be punished not for having tempted men to sin, says one Hasidic master, Rabbi Aaron of Karlin, but rather for having pretended that he acted in the name of God. As long as day and night are separate, everything is possible. Should their realms intermingle, both will be cursed. And such, I believe, is a stirring lesson of the Jewish tradition. It is in discernment, in Havdalah, that truth becomes manifest. For creation to be revealed, God must recede with his secrets, says the Kabbalah. Blessed be the Lord for having given the rooster the ability to distinguish between darkness and light, says the Jewish man who is pious every morning. And after the seventh day, as twilight falls, what does he say? Blessed be the Lord for having set apart the Sabbath from the rest of the week, the sacred from the profane. Let the separations be abolished, and it will be apocalypse. As a child, I dreaded the messianic times. I wasn't alone. In the Midrashic literature, we have so many descriptions of the terrible things that will precede the coming of the Messiah. There is a great sage, Rabbah, who said, Yetei velo achminei, I want him to come, but I don't want to be around. It's too dangerous, too painful. So I dreaded the messianic times, and yet I prayed every day they would come. And I was not the only one to have such conflicting feelings. I wish, many of us wish, to be able to be there when history would move in the direction of redemption rather than destruction. Kafka was right, perhaps, in saying that the Messiah will not arrive on the last day, but on the day after, too late for too many people. And you heard my friend Rabbi Pollack say about those times. For many, it would come too late. Some of you know, of course, the song Anim Amin, which is one of the most beautiful songs that I know in my repertoire. This is the 12th commandment of Maimonides. Anim Amin b'munah shlema. I believe in full faith, b'viat HaMashiach, in the coming of the Messiah. V'af al pi she'itmameh. And although he will be late in coming, im kol ze achakelo b'chol yom she'avu, I shall wait every day for him to come. When you study the text, you realize there is a grammatical error. It should be in the present, not in the future. V'af al pi she'mitmameh. And although he is late in coming, and yet it is said in the future, he will be late in coming. Now, how can I say every day I'm waiting in the future? And I think it included those times when we knew for some surely he came too late. And we felt then again, what does it mean then? What does it mean for us? What does it mean for those who believe in progress, in culture, in civilization, that there is a future, to the future, when we have seen what humanity is capable of doing to itself by doing certain unspeakable things to human beings only because of who they were, Jews. So you see, the apocalypse is really when the world is not only separate, not only divided, split between good and evil. It's between the dark sparks from one entering the light of the other. And so therefore for us, for my generation at least, the apocalypse was not in the distant future, but in the immediate present. Some days we needed only to go into the street to perceive it. Danger was everywhere. For us there was no solid ground anywhere, always in exile, always in flight. The world of humanity, of human happiness, eluded us. Often we had a feeling that we were living out the curses of the scripture. At night we waited for dawn, and at dawn we waited for night. In the morning, we wondered, are we still alive? Driven out of every place, pursued everywhere, accused of every misdeed, blamed for every evil, we did not understand what was happening around us. We seemed to live in a separate universe, to speak a separate language. And when people looked at us, they seemed to glimpse an ancient vision of terror. We, on the other hand, had nowhere to look, expelled from geography. We sought refuge in books. Therein we discovered the glory and suffering of another time, and we used it for guidance and support. We recounted the suffering of our ancestors in Egypt, and suddenly our own seemed more tolerable. We spoke of the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem, the murderous persecution at the time of the Crusades from Mayence to Blois to Jerusalem, the victims of the Inquisition, the burning of the synagogues during the pogroms. We felt strangely reassured, even encouraged. Times were tough, well, hadn't they always been? Yet we were still around, unchanged. The apocalypse, we knew how to survive it. Through endless dying, we had learned the art of survival. We considered the future, I mean the immediate future, with apprehension. Any changes for the worse, that was our conviction. Even our friends treated us differently when they came to power. Whoever persecutes Jews established himself as a leader according to the Talmud. And conversely, whoever attains a position of power takes to persecuting Jews. We felt in diaspora, in exile. So it was better to endure the known, familiar punishment of those already in power. In our prayers, we spoke of the days that passed, not of those to come. Rooted in the past, we responded to the present. To look beyond was to sense the imminence of the final age, that of the apocalypse. Now that's something one must not do. The apocalypse does not have good press in Jewish tradition. We admire Ezekiel, and we like Isaiah because, like Jeremiah, they do not let their vision and their discourse sink into melancholy. They offer consolation and hope. Certain works of merit, both from an ethical and literary standpoint, have not been included in the sacred canon because they are imbued with too much despair. Ben Sira, Baruch Dalet, the Maccabees, they are beautiful texts equal to Kohelet, to Ecclesiastes, or the Proverbs of Solomon. And yet they have been excluded because there is no way out. Once you enter them, there is no hope. Even Job could have had the same fate. His book, years passed before it was accepted in the canon because it was too sad. I know personally, I do not wish my books to bring despair to young people especially. I don't think I was born for that. I don't think I survived for that. To offer more reasons to despair, no. They have enough. And therefore, in one novel which I wrote, I kept the manuscript for a very long time. It's a book about the Alzheimer. Once I spoke about it here in this place, called The Forgotten. And I kept it because I didn't know what to do with it. There is no way out. There is nothing worse than that. It's not even a disease. It's a malediction. It's a curse. And once it strikes, it's the end. I compared it to a book. Every day you tear out a page, and another page, and another page, and then at the end there are no more pages, only the covers. And that's the patient of the Alzheimer's. And I decided, I cannot publish that. There's no way out. There's no door, nothing. Until I found something, at least a ray of redemption. And then I published it. So, where are we now? We can say, of course, on one hand, woe unto us, that we have, in our generations at least, discovered absolute evil, but not absolute truth. Woe unto a generation that we have discovered that at times of darkness and pain and agony, it is human to be inhuman. Woe unto us that we look into ourselves and we wonder where is hope to be found and we don't find it. And therefore, thank God we have one way of continuing is to look to the other. And so, evil is when I look only in myself. I fight evil by looking into the other. When very depressed, it's enough to look into the eyes of a child, into the smile of a young person, boy or girl, who loves or is going to love, open to love. Or you listen to the wisdom of an old man or woman who is ready to give all that he or she has learned from life to those who were born after. That, I believe, is a response to evil, because it cuts evil. It's very simple. As we enter the conclusion of the last lecture this year, the last encounter this year, what I have learned is very, very simple. The danger is really not evil, because we know how to discern it. We have the experience. We listen to those who have been the victims of evil. The danger remains the indifference to evil. Because of that indifference, evil prevails. It's only when we are indifferent that evil can triumph. And indifference, therefore, is what we must fight. And I would say, where does redemption begin? We are asked about evil, when does evil begin? When does redemption begin? I believe in messianic moments much more than the messianic period. A great Hasidic master said that sometimes we speak about a great tzaddik or a great genius. One can be a tzaddik for a moment. It's enough. One can be a great tzaddik for an hour. I believe the same is true of the messianic moments. And I really believe that when teacher and student, friend and friend meet, that's a messianic moment. And life is not made of years, but of moments. Some are moments of grace, and I hope they multiply, they last. And so I would just leave you with one very simple word. Redemption begins when indifference ends. Thank you.
You've just heard the last of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was entitled Evil and Redemption. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skoog, with help from Ian Hughes. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.